from Bright Umbrella, this is Control ClickCast. We inspect the web for you. Today, we're talking about accessibility with special guest, Greg Tarnoff. I'm your host, Leah Alcantara, and I'm joined by my fab co-host,
Emily Lewis.
Today's episode is sponsored by Ellis Lab. The Expression Engine community is busy this summer. The developer preview of version 3.0 has been released. A new focus group program is underway, and preparations are being made for a special edition of the Expression Engine conference. Follow it all on the ellislab.com blog or sign up to the newsletter at expressionengine.com/newsletter.
You know, that was the first I actually saw or heard that sponsor message. And it's so exciting they're in version 3. That's pretty exciting.
I know.
All right. Well, before we get to today's episode, Leigh and I wanted to once again thank all our listeners and supporters for nominating us for the NET Awards. Sadly, we didn't make the shortlist. But the nomination alone really means so much to us.
Absolutely. Especially when we get such amazing feedback from new and longtime listeners in our reviews and on Twitter every single week, actually. So hearing firsthand from people we make this podcast for, that's really all we want. So thank you so much for the nomination. Thank you for the reviews and thanks for all the support.
Ditto. So now to today's topic, accessibility, which it comes up several times over the course of this podcast, but we've never, embarrassingly, had an episode dedicated entirely to it. So today we're changing that with special guest Greg Tarnoff, who will be helping us understand the basics of accessibility, including the benefits, the challenges, and the ways we as designers and developers can help create a web for everyone. Greg is an accessibility and user experience consultant and developer with a passion for building products that work for all users. Welcome to the show, Greg.
Thanks for having me on.
So, Greg, can you tell our listeners a bit more about yourself?
I love scotch.
You and my husband will get along.
Yeah, I got into drinking scotch about 2 years ago. Maybe it was 3 years ago. I don't even remember at this point. And so I don't drink very much anymore because going out to the bars has gotten very, very expensive.
Yeah.
I'm also a single father to teenagers who are getting ready to kick out of the house in the next couple of years. Very excited about that.
Countdown.
Exactly. It's like, I can get a one-bedroom apartment? Huh. And, you know, I'm into photography, camping, art, you know, hanging out, overall geek, comics, movies, that kind of stuff.
Oh, so fun. So fun.
So how did you get into the web to start with? Did you go to school for that or you just started teaching yourself?
Sort of. I hit a point, I was in sales for a long time and I hit a point where it was just like, I did not want to go to work. And so I was like, okay, well, what do I want to do? Well, I really like photography. I really like computers and I really like teaching. So it was like, I was going to do one of these three things, but the time investment it took to get into photography or teaching and going back to school and everything like that was quite long. So I explored being a systems administrator. And was taking courses on how to do that and discovered the wonderful world of web development in the meantime and ended up doing that instead.
Yeah, I feel like so many in our industry, they kind of just start dabbling and then it's like, oh, now it's a full-time job.
Yeah, it was one of those things where I was figuring that, I'll put my photography up on a website. Maybe I can sell some of it that way. I was highly delusional at that time. But nonetheless, I put it up there and built my first website with Adobe Go Live. And then a few weeks later, somebody introduced me to Dreamweaver. And here I'm doing WYSIWYG. And I'm thinking I'm really cool. And about a month into Dreamweaver, you know, I stopped looking at the WYSIWYG side. And was just looking at the code side. And here I am 10 years, 11 years, 12 years down the road. I don't even remember at this point. And I work in Vim.
Oh, nice.
So Great. Basically, in my mind, this is our first accessibility episode. And we're
going to,
expand our content over this. But today's going to be the basics. And so how would you define accessibility?
Accessibility really is just good user experience. If you really spend the time to focus on the user experience and think of all the ways something can be done and improved, it's going to work for everybody. And that's really what it comes down to, is this a really good user experience that works for everybody.
How did you start focusing in accessibility?
So I got my first taste of it when I was trying to learn to be a systems admin. I kind of shifted gears and learned how to build websites. And one of the courses to get the certification, which is completely useless at this point, required going through a Section 508 class. And so I did this online course on Section 508, and it just sort of stuck with me from the very beginning. And then about 2.5 years ago, instead of just being involved and aware of it, and I actually developed a disability myself, and now it's kind of renewed my focus and pushed me a little bit further into making sure that we build a really accessible web.
For our listeners, can you explain a little bit about what Section 508 is?
So Section 508 is a portion of law regarding government contracts and electronic systems. And the idea is that the government wants to make sure that they have accessible systems. They passed this law in 1996, and it was designed to make sure that they were bringing in computer systems and software that anybody could use without any discrimination. It only really applies to government work, though. And that does include state and local levels and anybody that would be a subcontractor to the government.
Yeah, I think, gosh, I'd have to, it's long before I moved out here to New Mexico, so it was at least 10 or 11 years ago, I worked as a subcontractor for a government agency for the Department of Housing and Urban Development, and that's what I did. I did all their 508 testing, making sure that all the different sites that they had internally and externally tested and then validated, and if it didn't, went in and fixed it. And the really funny thing is I had to fix it in Front Page, because that's what they had bought. Like, that's what the software was.
The interesting thing about 508 is it really hasn't been updated since the 90s. And if you were to follow it to the letter at this point, we wouldn't be having any JavaScript in our applications. And that's one of the things that not a lot of people realize. The good thing is that, you know, it's up for review and they're trying to make amends and they're trying to make it better. So hopefully it'll be matching the WCAG 2.0 standards pretty soon.
Well, I hope I'm not putting you on the spot on this, but who reviews this stuff? Do you know the Section 508 specifically?
I actually don't know who specifically reviews it. I do know that they put this stuff out there for public comments a little while back, and they were getting some really good feedback on it. It's one of the congressional organizations that puts this stuff together, though.
And you also mentioned WCAG. Can you sort of define that for our listeners as well?
Web Content Accessibility Guidelines. So this is a subgroup out of the W3C that puts together a bunch of guidelines, not really rules, but they put together a spec on how to actually make things robust and accessible. And they are on their second version, and there's three levels, single A, double A, and triple A. And most government agencies at this point and laws being requiring people to adhere to accessibility standards are hitting that double A level.
Excellent. I love talking about this stuff. I'm like seriously opening up link after link of stuff you're opening to make sure I've got this stuff bookmarked. All right. So let's talk about why accessibility is important. I mean, you explained in your definition earlier about making sure that systems, that the user experience works for everybody. But why is it specifically important with a website? How does it benefit users? How do different users with different disabilities experience the web that isn't accessible?
Yeah, well, about 20% of the people that are on the internet right now actually struggle to use it in one fashion or another. And it's a wide variety of things. There's neurological issues. People that are dyslexic, for example, have a hard time reading some of the fonts that we put out there. People with low vision may not be able to see the small fonts. And the people that are completely blind obviously can't even see the screen. But then we also get into video, and all of our video has audio in it. People who are deaf can't hear what's being said in there. And so accessibility really focuses in on making an equal user experience across the board and getting that 20% of the population that's been struggling to be able to use the sites and do more with it at an equal level.
What do you think the benefit also for like a front-end developer is to follow? See, I hate to phrase it because it's not, in my mind, you don't really build accessibility. You follow good standards-based development and you test for accessibility. So how does it benefit a developer from taking that kind of approach?
Well, if they're doing it, if they're building accessibly and they're building quality code, they're going to build long-lasting, future-friendly code, things that they're not going to have to come back and repair 6 months, 8 months, a year and a half down the line because it broke because some browser out there all of a sudden added this new feature that we hadn't thought of when we originally built the code. So it becomes really future friendly. The idea of progressive enhancement is really, really key with accessibility. You know, write semantic HTML and then add your CSS to make sure the contrast and the colors are going to, you know, be strong enough, and then add your behavior through JavaScript on top of that, and, you know, go one step further and even add in ARIA stuff. And the reality of it is that if everything but the HTML fails, the site is still accessible and it's still usable. And no matter what the future brings, as long as we support HTML, which HTML5 is the new standard and it is backwards compatible, we will be able to make sure that that site is usable.
So would you say, and this might be like overlapping a little bit about benefits to clients, developing with accessibility in mind, that improves search engine optimization simply because all the information, like you said, if you strip down JavaScript, you strip down everything, and if the code and the content is written down properly, that the computer / Google / a robot can still read all the content that's available on the site, right?
Exactly. And, you know, the search engines have gotten really good at being able to read single page applications and Angular style dynamically loaded things. But if you can get it down to what it was originally designed, and that is the HTML document, that's where the content is. If it's there, it's definitely going to help with your search engine optimization. You know, video has great content, but there are still struggles with being able to really pull out the SEO value of video. But if you have a transcript, which allows you to then also do captioning, and the transcript is on your page below the video or next to the video, not only is it accessible, but it also gaining the SEO value.
Yeah, I feel like accessibility, it's accessible to everything, everyone, every device, whatever machine is going to consume the content, or human.
Yeah, it doesn't matter if it's a watch or a Braille display or a television, anything can use it. You know, your refrigerator will be spitting out the HTML pages before you know it. And if we don't stick to those standards, we don't know how we're going to actually accomplish that.
So how else would developing with accessibility in mind and promoting accessibility benefit clients?
Well, like I said before, the 1 in 20 struggle to use the web. And, you know, if you go to your client and say, hey, I'm going to spend about 10% extra time, do this little work over here, but I'm going to increase your user base by 20%.
Right.
I don't know any client that would say, please don't do that. So that's the big thing. On the flip side of it, you know, you hopefully will avoid lawsuits.
Right. Do you think that is an actual motivating factor for a lot of clients? I mean, sometimes we hear like the stories of someone suing someone because a major website or a major corporation company didn't make their site accessible. But for a quote, regular small business or a smaller organization, do you believe, you know, lawsuits actually, they even understand that exists?
I guess I hope that they understand that it exists. And as professionals, it's our job to be able to convey that message that, look, we're going to do this right for you. And if we don't do it right, here are the consequences that you can face. And we're not going to be held liable if you make us do it wrong. But we want to do it right so that you can then go on and say, hey, I did it right. And then you can spread the word that we helped you get there. So I think it's important for us to do as professionals, but I don't think that they truly understand. You know, people are like, well, you know, that big store with the red logo on it, you know, they got sued because they're a Fortune 500 company, multinational conglomerate. And, you know, I own one shop in middle of nowhere, USA. Nobody's going to sue me. Well, eventually somebody's going to sue you.
Well, I really do think that it is our job as web professionals to educate our clients about the role of accessibility and how it's really setting them up for not just avoiding a lawsuit or increasing that 20% potential of their audience, but it's just good fundamental web development. Like that that is the kind of foundation from which they can scale in the future. And we don't emphasize accessibility when we sell our projects to a client. You know, we aren't an accessibility shop, you know, like Simply Accessible is or something like that. You know, if we had a client that had those needs, we would refer them to a shop that really focuses in on it. But that's how we do follow standards-based development. We do minimal testing for accessibility. I have ARIA roles and I have, you know, different ARIA attributes in place where I think it makes the most sense for what we're building. And I don't go into those specific details with the client, but they do know that those things are in place and that it's something that I remember we had a client who in the estimate, he's like, well, I don't really want all that stuff. And I told him, well, that's how I build it. So that's what you're
exactly.
getting.
Exactly.
When you've got a customer like that, you know, the way I would turn it is when you buy a car, you know, you may not know how the brakes work, but you know that they work, you know that they're there. And that's the same kind of thing. You know, this is what happens underneath the hood. You don't need to know all the details about it, but just know that it needs to be there so that you can accomplish what you're trying to do here.
I feel like, though, that this is touching on the challenges and hurdles to accessibility. I feel like a lot of clients don't know what they don't know. So, for example, the one that Emily mentioned, he's like, oh, I don't need that. Well, you kind of do. You know, so Greg, what do you think then are the misperceptions about accessibility and the biggest challenges to it?
So I think there's really two. The big one is that it costs a lot of money to make something accessible. And it really only costs a lot of money to make something accessible if you've already spent a lot of money to build it and didn't think about accessibility at the beginning. Do it at the beginning and you're building solid HTML and standards based, you're getting a lot of stuff for free. And then if you do a little bit of work and add in the ARIA roles and make sure that anything that you're doing is readable by a simple screen reader and accessible by a keyboard, all of things which are relatively easy to get your hands on, because you can, if you're doing Windows development, you can run NVDA with Firefox to test for a screen reader. Everybody can, you know, throw away their mouse for a minute and try to access everything on the site just using the keyboard without taking their hands off of it. If you're on a Mac, you do have VoiceOver built in, and Android devices and has TalkBack, and iOS have VoiceOver. So these aren't tools that you have to go out and spend a lot of money for if you're already spending money on equipment. And it can get expensive to be a web developer. They're there, and if you do the solid work up front, you're going to get a lot of that for free. The second biggest thing is that when it comes to accessibility, the biggest misconception is like, oh, well, if it works for a screen reader, it's accessible. Right. No, it's not. You know, there's so much more to it. You know, I mentioned neurodiversity, you know, people with cognitive issues. You also have mobility issues, people with Parkinson's disease and trying to hit a target that's just a couple of pixels high on your, you know, because it's just an icon, or, you know, as well as vision and hearing. I have a vestibular disorder. Animation drives me insane, because it makes me feel like I'm falling off the planet. So there's a lot of different ways accessibility comes into play. And if we really take our time and we think about that, we can actually build some tools that are fun and dynamic, but we want to give the user a little bit of control so that they can have that experience the way they need to have it.
And I think it also, at least in my experience, it helps. Because to talk to someone who may not have firsthand experience with a disability or a challenge that makes technology in particular challenging for them, but it helps to sort of bring it down to something that they can relate to. For example, all of us have aging parents, perhaps grandparents. They have their own issues utilizing technology because of, you know, age-related challenges, or even something as simple you break your own arm, like you have a broken arm and you can't use that arm for 2 months while it heals. Like all of a sudden, you know, the fact that you can't buy something off of Target.com becomes an issue.
Well, it gets even simpler than that. Take your contacts out or take your glasses off.
Right.
I'm blind as a bat without my contacts or glasses.
I've got about 12 inches that I can see, and that's about it, you know. The thing is accessibility. We have it all around us. We're using accessible tools to enhance our experience all the time. It's just we keep forgetting about it when we start building the web.
So we asked a little bit about what the benefits are to clients and developers and even users. I'm curious, we haven't really talked about the role of designers yet with accessibility. You know, me as the front-end developer, I'm building this stuff, but are there things that designers can do to take into account accessibility when they're coming up with those concepts?
The biggest one is to focus on contrast. So there are, under WCAG, there are rules about how much contrast foreground and background have. And we want to make sure that we are hitting those targets on the contrast so that things are going to stand off and be readable. That's going to help people with low vision. But on the flip side, we don't want to go too far. Solid black lettering on a white background or the reverse of that can be very difficult for people to read. So if you just tone back your black from 000 to 333 and take your white from, you know, FFF to something like EFEFEF, then you, most people, 90% of the population out there won't be able to tell the difference. But that little bit of change can actually prevent physical pain in somebody who is autistic or who has issues with their vision. So there's little things like that that we want to consider, you know, making sure that we've got enough contrast, but not too much. And that's one of the big things. The other thing is when we're doing the design, not everybody understands icons.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting. Yeah.
So using icons and text together makes things work a lot better. So again, with the autism is a great example is a lot of autistic people don't actually get the social constructs around our icons. You know, we joke about the floppy disk as being a save icon, and kids these days don't know what a floppy disk is. Or, Dad, you 3D printed the save icon? Well, they actually know what it is, but they don't have the social construct on it.
Right.
So people who have difficulty dealing in social situations are going to have a much harder time with that. Or if you go international, here in the United States, we've got shopping carts. And, you know, there are these wheeled carts we push around the grocery stores. Well, the idea of a shopping cart is not so well known in the UK. It's a shopping trolley. But then you move into a developing world and they don't have these wheeled behemoths that they push around the markets. They have bags. And so seeing a shopping cart icon in a developing nation is going to confuse the user. But if we said shopping bag or had a bag icon that was a little bit more internationalized, then they'd be less confused. So making sure that you're considering that those kinds of things becomes really important. And then with animation, I don't want to say don't use animation, but don't overuse animation. Don't animate just to animate. Animate because it's going to make things a little bit easier for the customer and the user to understand what the process is, and make sure that if you are doing bigger animations, you give the user control. Let them know with a clue of some sort, you know, play this animation or click this to do this or some way to just give them a little clue that's going, what's going to happen next so that they're not going to be shocked by it when it happens.
You know, it goes back to the very first thing you said. It's just good user experience. You're thinking about different users and trying to make it as easy for them as possible to interact with your site.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a lot of people, I think what people don't seem to understand is that we actually know a lot of people with some sort of disability. It's just not maybe overt, right? So sometimes people think about, you know, accessibility as like, oh, we're trying to fix overt situations where this person is completely blind, you know, as opposed to just slightly visually impaired. But improving things overall will help all those types of people. You know, for example, one of our clients is actually colorblind. And on occasion, I forget. So, for example, he'd ask me like, so what is the hex of this? He doesn't even know it was yellow because the yellow looks like gray to him. And for me, sometimes when he asks me, I'm like, oh, yeah, it's the yellow. It's the yellow. And he's like, well, could you just give me the hex code? Because I have no idea what that actually is, you know?
Yeah, well, another one is the content that we write. So the average reading level for people globally is around the 13, 14-year-old mark, or about eighth grade. And so when we're writing content, if we're not considering that or considering our audience, then we're developing things that they're not going to be able to understand. You know, I mean, if you happen to be writing a doctoral thesis on quantum engineering, you don't have to write it to the eighth grade level because your audience is very specific. But if you don't know who your audience is because you're building an e-commerce site or you're building a blogging platform, then making sure that you're writing to that level is going to make sure that you reach the largest audience possible.
I mean, even that ties back to our recent episode we had with Steph Hay about content first design, and it's using the language of your audience. You know, you're not trying to be, we're the smartest people on the web. You know, you're trying to connect with people. And so using language that's going to connect is really critical.
Yes. Getting your content first. I reject all things that people want me to design if they don't have the content written.
So let's talk a little bit about what some foundational things that developers should do to support accessibility. Like, let's say someone's not sure, they haven't really thought about accessibility, so they're not really sure where to kind of start embracing it.
The start would be to just have the mindset that there's people out there that are not like you. And you need to ask people that are different than you, what is a problematic for them to use on the internet? As long as we can keep that open mind that we are unique in the way we do things and we need to talk to other people, we're going to go really far. On top of that, once you actually get into building the code and building the site and building the project, semantic HTML. Don't reinvent the wheel. If you are going to be having something that when you click on it is going to take an action on the page, don't throw Angular's ng-click on there, you know, then have to go back and return that into something else through a bunch of ARIA roles and extra JavaScript when all you need to do is throw a button on it. The button's already built in. It has all those features for the accessibility that we already need. Or if it's going to be navigating you to another portion of the site, make it an A tag. You don't need to go and reinvent the wheel there. So I think if we keep that in mind, we get a lot for free. I like saying that because it really is free. And then from there, just building things up, making sure that we're doing solid progressive enhancement and that we can always fall back to that just HTML document. So those are the big things. I mean, if you want to get a little bit more specific, you know, again, having user control of animation, sound, audio, anything really kind of unique and special going on in the site, you know, scroll jacking, try to avoid that. Parallax can cause a lot of motion sickness with people. If we've got any audio or video, making sure that we've got captions and transcripts. Some people just want to read it. Some people want the real time. You could even go one step further and do the American Sign Language, do a sign interpretation of it and have that video run simultaneously. A lot of people don't think about that one. Avoiding things like Flash. I mean, for the most part, Flash is dead. But if you're using Flash for video, which still seems to be the legacy there, there really is no need anymore. We can do it with HTML5 and we can make it more accessible.
You know, you've mentioned ARIA a couple times. For me, this was sort of, so basically I've always been a huge fan of semantic HTML, which really got me into having a little love affair with structured data, specifically microformats, because it's sort of building off of what's already there, describing the content just a little further. And I felt like ARIA, when I saw ARIA roles, that was just another step to sort of describe what I'm building to make it a little more accessible. And it was an easy way for me to sort of make the jump into understanding even more about ARIA. So could you talk a little bit about ARIA, what it is, and maybe explaining the roles that I just mentioned?
So ARIA is, again, out of the W3C. It's a spec that they're working on constantly. And ARIA stands for Accessible Rich Internet Applications. It really came out of the world of Java applets and Flash and things like that. And when we were starting to really kind of move away from the static document and trying to provide ways to communicate through the screen readers and other accessible technology what was going on the screen. The main areas are ARIA roles. These are landmarks that we can put into our code so that a person can say that this chunk of content is my navigation. This one is complementary information or an aside, or we can do a figure, the main content of the website versus a footer or a header. With HTML5, we have a lot of these new tags, and they become, the new tag is sort of duplicating what the roles were doing. But older screen readers and assistive technology aren't caught up to HTML5. So we still need those ARIA roles in there. The other thing that we have are states. So we might have a tab panel that may be selected, or an accordion. Is it expanded? Is it collapsed? ARIA will communicate that back to the user through their assistive technology. We can tell it that this particular label that is on the left-hand side of the screen is associated with this piece of content that's on the right-hand side of the screen. And even though there is a visual disparity there, the person who can't see that and make that connection will be able to have that communicated to them through the technology as well. And then I think one of the areas that really needs more time invested with it is the ARIA live region concept. Because we're doing dynamic single page applications where JavaScript will go and fetch a piece of data and it will change just a portion of the page, as opposed to doing a refresh, we need to communicate to the user that that part of the page has made a change. And that's where a live region comes in. And we can tell the live region to be polite, which means that when I stop reading this particular thing or stop doing this particular thing on this area of the site, it will say, hey, I've got new content for you. Here's what it is. Or we can make it assertive where it will actually interrupt you. And so if you've got filling in a form and you've got an error message that comes through a live region, that's the kind of thing you want to be assertive. Whereas, hey, you've got new tweets is something you want to wait until the person pauses.
Right, right. Wow, Greg, I'm learning a lot, because when I first started thinking about, you know, accessibility, yes, I was thinking about, you know, making the web available for everyone. But I didn't even think about the fact that these live regions, just things that I take for granted as someone who just interacts with the web without much issue, that people might not be able to access that information because it's too fancy with the show hide or Ajax or whatever else is happening in the background.
Yeah, I get really excited about all the new things that we can do and moving away from the fact that this was just a static document and it's so much more alive. You know, it's more interesting than video games because it's not this guided concept, you know, and it's more interesting than television or even reading a book because we can do all these fun things. But not everybody appreciates them. Or worse, they make people physically ill. And we never want to do that. You don't want to screw somebody up just because we, you know, we got the latest trick that we want to show off.
So I'm curious, say you are a designer and developer and you are starting or trying to apply accessibility, you know, concepts in your workflow. What do you think is the biggest mistake that somebody who is well-intentioned, who is somebody who's trying to apply this, what do you think is a very common mistake that designer or developer does?
I think it's the concept that, well, maybe they don't really need this. And it's one of those things where you come up with an idea, you think that it's going to work, and then you try to think of it and look at it from different angles and different user mindsets. And if you can't get into that mindset, it becomes easier to dismiss it. And it actually is very difficult to get into somebody else's perspective and see how the world is, you know, from their angle. And that empathy that is needed is super, super important for a designer. If we can't get into that, then you have a tendency to blow it off. And I actually had a client who complained about the application that we had available, didn't want to purchase it. It was a proprietary CMS for building out websites for small engine makers. They didn't want to purchase it because it wasn't accessible to the blind. And we're like, you sell lawnmowers. How many people do you have that are blind using a lawnmower? And he's like, well, I have one. But he does his own repairs. He buys his own parts. This is his thing. This is what the guy does. And he doesn't want to lose this customer because nobody else is going to help this customer. And he wanted to take care of that. And he wasn't willing to invest in our product because of that. And so it may only be one person, but that one person may be very important.
Absolutely. So do you think there's anything that leadership managers can do to support accessibility? You know, we've talked about some things developers can do in coding and testing, things designers can do when creating. What about managing and leading?
It has to start there. You know, we can be, as coders, we as developers, we can do everything we want. But if our manager finds out that we are spending 5% or 10% or 20% of our time making this thing accessible and they didn't approve it, they're going to come down on us and they're going to say, well, why are you bothering to do that? You're wasting my time. You're wasting my money. So we need to have the management supportive. If we can get the management on board, you know, the only way we're going to get them on board is if we can show them the ROI or show them that this is a very small investment, but yet here's what we're going to get in return from it, or what we're going to avoid through, you know, legal scenarios. Then they'll get on board. And when they're on board, they're going to insist on it. And that's going to make it happen all the way throughout the organization.
I guess I'm a manager because I own my own business. I think it's also something that I have a responsibility as well to highlight it for customers. You know, that it's not necessarily me as the developer communicating to a client about the importance of accessibility, but me as a business owner conveying it to a client, looking for clients who want to support that. I think that probably has some sort of role as well.
Yeah, definitely.
So let's talk a little bit about what you just mentioned, the cost of accessibility. You said earlier on, and I couldn't agree with you more, that if you build right from the start, accessibility is not a costly endeavor. What is costly is remediation, going back and fixing something after the fact. And so I was wondering, can you talk a little bit about that sort of after the fact fixing and the kind of the impact that that can have on a business, how it has to respond to making those changes cost-wise as well as legal-wise?
Yeah, well, it's hard to put numbers on these things because every project is going to be a little bit different, the size of it, the scope of it. But when it comes down to doing it, if we do it beforehand, the cost of doing an accessible platform at the beginning is actually going to be less than supporting legacy browsers.
Oh, wow. That's a good analogy to draw it to.
You know, if you have to support IE9 and below, you are going to spend more money and more time getting those to work than you would in making an accessible site. That being said, you know, there were some numbers that were being tossed around. I know that in my quotes for things, when I had to support IE6, you know, well, that was a 50% increase in the cost of doing things just for supporting IE6. And you know, IE8 was maybe a little bit less and IE9 maybe a little bit less than that. But, you know, we put in these sort of astronomical numbers because it did take so much more work to actually get those done because they weren't built off of the semantic standards that would apply everywhere else. And that's sort of the same thing that comes in now is if you build an application, I would say that you're going to spend between one third and one half of the cost to rebuild that application if you're going to have to do all that rework and retrofit it. And it's going to be higher the more you're, if you're doing more of a single page application and you're using sort of the standard build practice of applying these click and hover events to all these different things that don't normally have them. And so if we consider that at the beginning, we can cut a lot of that cost out. And yeah, I think that's really probably the areas that you're going to spend that kind of money. And there's lawsuits too. The DOJ is stating that, you know, you have to have accessible websites. So they're going to start suing people that aren't accessible. Even though the ADA doesn't say anything right now, the DOJ is going to be going after it.
Yeah, that was just, what was it, June 29th, I saw, or I guess at the end of June, this sort of announcement from the Justice Department came out. And I think it's really exciting. I mean, it basically says that if you have a public accommodation, a public business, a public service, then your website has to be accessible.
I'm all for that.
Yeah. And I also feel like I've noticed, I know I enjoy a special place getting to talk to people on this podcast who are really invested in our industry, but it feels like there seems to be a shift towards accessibility amongst web pros. It seems to be a hot topic all of a sudden. People are really talking about it a lot more frequently than they had before.
They definitely are. And I think a big piece of that is because there's this subculture in web that has emerged called user experience. It's no longer about design. It's no longer the web designer. It's no longer the UI guy. It's user experience. It's who talks to the customer and what is that conversation like? And it's the entire thing. And as people get into that and they start looking at how we're doing things, accessibility starts standing out as this big red thumb, and they're taking it into consideration and they're building for it and factoring it in at the beginning. And if you're doing good user experience, and so many companies are now pushing that model, we're going to get better just by following that.
So as we near the end of the episode, let's talk about some of your favorite resources and things like that. So what would be some of your top recommendations for learning about accessibility?
Well, there's a hashtag on Twitter, A11Y, and the 11 is 11 because there's 11 characters in accessibility. And that is a really good hashtag to follow if you're looking for a variety of conversations or learnings, things to pick up on, job resources, good articles. That's one of the best things you can probably do out there. There's a lot of good writing from Passiello Group and Simply Accessible and the Alley Project. Those are some really good resources, along with WAVE and the webaim.org. to have out there. And then you can get even a little bit more niche-y stuff that doesn't focus on the web, but it focuses on the actual issues that people deal with. So for instance, vestibular.org is a website that I visit on a regular basis. It's about vestibular disorders. And I will read some of the stories that are on there and figure out how those apply to what I'm doing.
Oh, that's such a great suggestion. You know, it's one of the things Leah and I are learning in our own business. And it amazes me that it's taken us this long to learn it, but we have to go where the people we are working for are. You know, we need to meet them in the, you know, we need to get outside our little web bubble where we geek out about standards and, you know, things like that, and talk to the people, engage with the people, meet the people that we're building websites for. And that's a perfect example of that being extremely practical, especially from an accessibility standpoint. So let's talk about resources for validating or testing accessibility.
Sure. There's a lot of stuff out there. Some of them are good, some of them are great, and some of them are getting better. WAVE is a tool by WebAIM that you could drop a URL in and do a test on it and get some results back in a nice fashion. There's also some tools that you can plug in to some extensions for your browser. One of those is FireEyes by DQ. They actually will do some of the, it runs with Firebug on Firefox and will give you an idea of what you need to do in order to make your site more accessible. Khan Academy recently released a tool, accessibility, for testing and developing that. And then another one that's really great is Tenon.io. That was one that recently emerged, I think 2 or 3 months ago. I find that that one's really, really effective.
Excellent. So finally, what are your top three suggestions for web professionals who want to get more involved and to advocate for accessibility?
Find the channels where people are talking. So, you know, the Alley hashtag on Twitter. There's also a Slack channel out there.
Oh, Slack.
Yeah,
perfect.
There's a web accessibility Slack channel, and there's actually some user experience Slack channels that have web accessibility rooms in them. And get out there and ask questions. The one really cool thing about the accessibility people that are out there is they want to help people learn. Most of us are there to teach, and it's not just to do, but we want to teach and we want to expand it. And so they're happy to answer questions, no matter how stuck you may be, because the more people we get doing it, the better off we're all going to be. And then the other thing that I personally condone, and it doesn't work for everyone, so your mileage may vary. When it gets right down to it, just do it. Be subversive and do the right thing. And in the long run, people are going to thank you for it. It may take a long time, but that's just kind of how I roll. I've gotten into a lot of trouble in the past for it, but eventually they always thank me.
You do the work that reflects what you believe in. Absolutely. I loved this episode.
Yeah, Craig, I'm just like, this is amazing.
Well, I'm so happy that I could be here.
Well, before we finish up, we do have our rapid fire 10 questions so our listeners can get to know you a bit better.
All right.
Are you ready?
Yeah, I think so.
All right, first question, Android or iOS?
iOS.
If you were stranded on a desert island and can only bring three things, what would you bring?
Oh, wow. Water, because you can't drink the seawater. And I don't want to drink any other liquid that would be available. this is PG show, right? A knife and probably a good comic book.
Practicality and pleasure. What's your favorite TV show?
Right now, I am really digging Orphan Black.
Ooh, yes. Canadian show.
A Canadian show. Watched the first two seasons, and I'm so happy that Tatiana Maslany got nominated for an Emmy for this year. What I don't understand, she got nominated for the best leading actress in a drama, but I don't understand how she didn't also get nominated 5 times for the best supporting actress.
Yeah, totally.
We're just getting into that one, so I'm not a fan yet, but
love it.
Jason's very excited to watch it, so we've seen a couple episodes.
That and Sense8.
Oh.
I've seen that. I've heard a lot of people talking about that one. I'm afraid to add a new show to my list of shows that I still have to catch up on.
That's the wonder of streaming media these days, you know, binge watching.
All right. So next question, what's your favorite dessert?
Actually, I'd probably say orange, an actual orange.
What profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
Oh, gosh, actually, I would really want to be just an artist, you know, loft artist. I'm nowhere near good enough, but it would be really cool to just be able to create things on an unhindered.
What about a profession you would not like to try?
Sales.
Which you did, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
What's the latest article or blog post you read?
It was something on Everyday Feminism yesterday about men and feelings. It was actually
I read that same thing.
Yeah. I'm a man. I have feelings. And I talk about them openly on my website and on Twitter as well. And it was a really well-written article on how we've got such a double standard on feelings. Men aren't supposed to feel.
So if you could have a superpower, what would it be?
I'm actually going to go with speed.
Ooh, like the Flash?
I love the Flash. He's one of my favorite comic characters. And, you know, the whole concept there is it's not just speed. He has to have a body with strength and bones that can actually handle it as well.
Right. What music do you like to work to?
Depends on my mood. I would say most of the time I'm listening to something chill or house music. But if I'm really frustrated and struggling with a problem, out will come the punk rock and all the angsty music from my youth. And, when I'm driving, though, it's like I like to listen to the 80s.
All right. Last question. Cats or dogs?
Both. I'm not a cat person. Let me rephrase that. I was not a cat person. A little over a year ago, we adopted 3 kittens because my family wanted them. And we got 3 kittens from the same litter, Chicken, Waffles, and Gravy.
Oh, I love it! I love it!
And Gravy basically looked at me and said, you are mine, and you are going to cuddle with me, and I'm going to cuddle with you, and you are going to do everything I tell you to do. And, you know, as annoying as these critters can be, when I am feeling blue, the first thing Gravy does is he comes up and he either sits on my shoulder or sits in my lap, and it always makes me feel a little bit better. That being said, I don't have any dogs, but I really want a dog.
That's awesome. Well, that's all the time we have for today. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
In case our listeners want to follow up with you, where can they find you online?
Probably the easiest place is Twitter, which is just Greg Tarnoff on Twitter. Also on Instagram. And you can also visit my website, which is tarnoff.info. You can contact me through there.
Excellent. Thanks again, Greg.
Thank you.
Control Click is produced by Bright Umbrella, a web services agency obsessed with happy clients. Today's podcast would not be possible without the support of this episode's sponsor. Thank you, Ellis Lab.
We'd also like to thank our partners, Arcus Tech, DevOT, and EE Insider.
And thanks to our listeners for tuning in. If you want to know more about Control Click, make sure you follow us on Twitter at Control Click Cast or visit our website, controlclickcast.com. And if you like this episode, please give us a review on Stitcher or iTunes or both.
Don't forget to tune in to our next episode when we're going to talk about professionalism and the softer skills necessary for success in our industry with Dan Mall. Be sure to check out our schedule on our site, controlclickcast.com/schedule, for more upcoming topics.
This is Leia Alcantara
and Emily Lewis
signing off for Control Click Cast. See you next time.
Cheers.